Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
I had the great fortune of coming across an excellent author and book. Greg Fisseri wrote the book Gridiron Legacy, just came out recently, and was able to and honored to have Greg come on and talk about his book and the story it tells about his great-grandfather and pro football history. So fortunate to have Greg coming up in just a moment to tell us all about his great book and the story.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a very interesting story that we're going to be talking about tonight. We started this journey probably about a year ago when we had the author on talking about the Massillon Tigers pro football team. And he was in the process of getting his book published, which is The Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. The author is Greg Fisseri. Greg, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren. Great to be back with you. Thanks.
Yeah, Greg, this journey that you've had for the book, I know you were anxious about a year ago, hoping to get published, and with COVID and everything delaying everything around the world, your book came out in September, and really a fantastic book, and so excited that it launched and the people are getting their hands on it. So how have your life been since this book has been released?
Well, it's been quite a year. It was a little touch and go, as you said, getting the book delivered from the printer in South Korea during the COVID crisis and the supply chain situation. But it fortunately arrived just in time for the start of football season. And we were able to have a big, fun launch party in Atlanta, where I lived most of the time in early September. And that was hardly the end of the journey. It's sort of the end of a chapter and now the beginning of an entirely different type of experience, rolling it out and finally sharing with everybody. It's been a blast.
Yeah. You've had some big names, contributing to the book with forewords and, helping with guiding people to it. Maybe you could mention some of those folks that are in the book.
Yeah, Franco Harris in particular has been extremely helpful. I've known Franco a little bit off and on growing up, just met him a few times, but I really got to spend some quality time with him when I was working on an advisory board at the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh about 10 years ago. And I believe it or not, I've been working on the book that long. And when he learned about it, he's such a huge sports history and football history buff. He's the head of that committee. He was very proactive in offering his support, which was amazing. And he just said, whenever I was ready, however he could help. And I asked him to do the foreword eventually. And he jokingly, when I reached back out to him, said, did I really say I would do that? He said, oh, I'm just kidding. He wrote a beautiful, a heartfelt foreword for the book that's really special. And I'm honored to have him be a part of it.
Great way to kick the book off when you open it up and see it, and seeing so many other great kindred spirits in football history that were supported. The Ken Crippens and Joe Horgans and a plethora of others, just adding some great commentary and support to your writing. And it really is. It's a really, really nice book and very well done.
Thanks very much. Yeah, especially the historians Ken and Mark Ford, both at the PFRA, were very helpful along the way in editing, even, and just fact checking and things like that, which was great. And Joe Horrigan, of course, at the Hall of Fame, is just pretty much a cut above everybody else at this point in terms of football history, pro football history. And for him to sort of, give credibility to the book and say that, what I discovered in my grandmother's basement of these photographs from my great grandfather, Bob Shiring, from the Massillon Tigers, early 1900s teams, was finding a constitution to them, was really, special. And I'm glad he was willing to, lend support as well.
You told us that before, that you saw the photographs at your grandmother's basement, and your family knew a little bit about what they were about, but not a whole lot. And it's really started off your 10-year journey. Where did the journey go from there, from your grandmother's basement? How did you approach getting the history on your great-grandfather?
Yeah, there's a big difference between family lore and facts, right? Mm-hmm. So you might get bits and pieces, just little golden nuggets, from the family, just something about him being a great pro player before the NFL, and a couple of pictures that hung on the wall, and that he they were world champions, whatever that meant, but it was before the NFL. None of it all kind of made sense in any cohesive way, but it wasn't until she passed away in 2007 and we cleaned out her house in this little industrial suburb of Pittsburgh called Wilmerding, where they were a prominent family in that town, and I kind of understood that it was because of my great-grandfather and his reputation that led him to become a business professional and sort of the a magistrate and in the town and a leader, and that sort of, he was the patriarch of the family and everything that was to come. So when we cleaned out her house and I found this another box that, I have no idea where it was my whole life, because I was always in that house, and it was just in the basement, near the other things that I was always around, full of football photos from the early 1900s that connected his career, obviously, that I knew immediately. I remember saying to my mother that I was going to do something with these, and I didn't know what that was at the time, but it meant researching and identifying them and eventually leading me to the Hall of Fame once I had enough information, especially with the help of Bob Carroll, who was the founder of the Pro Football Researchers Association. Before he passed away, I was lucky enough to connect with him and give me a start on identifying some of these. And he really said, you really need to get this to the Hall of Fame and see what Joe has to say, because he and Joe worked together on pretty much every article that's online on the PFRA site on the early game. So with that validation is the word I was looking for earlier. It just kept the wind at my back, and in my sails to keep going. And once we had them all identified and Joe and Salim Chowdhury and John Kendall, all the great folks at the Hall of Fame said, look, if you can combine these photos with the narrative that's still incomplete on the 1906 gambling scandal and this kind of cold case that's still out there. And, was Blondie Wallace guilty or not? Was he colluding with the gamblers? It would be a really special story, because there's still much to be known about that.
Yeah. That's the basic, storyline that you have. You sort of, from what I gathered from reading it, you sort of have, these two stalwarts of early pro football, your great-grandfather, Bob Shiring, and Blondie Wallace, who they were sort of, nemesises throughout their pro careers. But their careers sort of paralleled each other. They played on great teams that opposed each other in two different states. But you took that story and you sort of made it almost a great encyclopedia of the first two decades of pro football. And I found that very interesting. You went all the way back to the beginning and started talking about the John Brilliers and Pudge Heffelfingers and, you know, the Pittsburgh era, telling a story of the Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania football and then the shift into Ohio, but keeping these central figures in line through the story. I just thought that was incredibly brilliant and a genius story, great story method.
Thanks. That is kind of how it worked out, you know, and I don't know if nemesis is actually the right word, because that sort of implies tension between the two of them. You know, they certainly faced off as rivals from the early Homestead teams that were world champions in 1900, 1901. You know, I think 1901 was the first year that Philadelphia came into the picture in the pro football with Blondie Wallace and challenged Homestead, and Homestead agreed to go across the state and play them and won again in 1901, 1902. But I never found any quote from Bob Schiering about Blondie. And the only things I ever read Blondie said about Bob were very complimentary about his play. The real rivalry that developed and animosity was between Blondie and Maslin's manager, E.J. Stewart, out once the game moved west out to Ohio after 1902. I mean, this E.J. Stewart was the original amateur quarterback for Maslin in 1901, 1902. And in 1903, he comes up with the idea to pitch the concept of pro football to the industrialists, the wealthy business people around Maslin, and say, hey, these guys, these players from Pittsburgh are available. You know, they're not playing professionally anymore. We could bring a few out and really, you know, dominate out here. So he successfully pulled that off and brought Schiering and three of his teammates from the Pittsburgh professionals, or the Stars that they were called in 1902, and that we're just playing amateur again in 1903 for the last championship game against Akron in 1903. And that sort of started the ball rolling in Ohio, and then eventually you know, Blondie comes out when Canton decides to jump in the mix in 1904, 1905. Canton's captain was injured in the game, and they went and recruited Blondie to come and take over. And the negotiations, because Blondie was really the captain, player, cap, and manager. So, you know, there were things on the field that were one thing, but the big rivalry escalated through the management negotiations. And this E.J. Stewart character, was, aside from being an initial quarterback, then the manager of the team, he was also the sports editor for the Maslin newspaper. He'd also been a, you know, city clerk. So he wore a lot of hats around Maslin, and he really sort of figured out, kind of like Dave Barry did in Latrobe, as a newspaper editor and, you know, Latrobe team manager, you know, for Brailleur and the others, that he could sell tickets through the paper and drive this rivalry, you know, with Greensburg and Latrobe's case. And Maslin, he just sort of stoked this, right? Always poking the people in Canton for the benefit of selling tickets and newspapers. And he really got under, you know, Blondie's skin and, you know, got his goat several times. And Blondie just wasn't having it. He was a very strong, you know, willed and smart guy, having played at Penn and been a national champion and elected captain before he dropped out of school for his senior year. But and he really started pro football in Philadelphia, you know, with Connie Mack. He got Connie Mack to invest in the first teams there. And so he had experience, you know, with negotiation in the business side of the game. And he wasn't going to be taken advantage of by this E.J. Stewart guy. And in the end, it just led to a rivalry that hasn't never died in Stark County.
Yeah, it's I mean, he's definitely an interesting character. I know he, even after playing in Philadelphia a little bit, Franklin, Pennsylvania had a team, which is not too far from where I am in Erie. Yeah. They had a champion team, like 1902, 1903.
That was 1903, you know, arguably maybe the best team ever of all of them. I mean, they were incredibly dominant, but they didn't really have any competition without the teams from Pittsburgh in the mix. But the team he assembled there was, you know, unparalleled.
Yeah, it was, but it's just an interesting thing how, you know, all these teams, you know, in early football, they said, hey, we're going to be the best team. And they'd throw a lot of money, grab the best players that they could. And they'd see, like, after a year or two, hey, this isn't, this is costing us money. This is going to make us go in, you know, going negative here a little bit financially. And then that sort of shifted to Ohio, and they saw, you know, their teams up and down and on the ledgers. And it's just a brilliant story. It's a great story. And I'm glad you could put it all together in one place where, you know, people could enjoy it and put the connections and, you know, link those stories together. Because I've only read them separately, you know, as teams and newspaper articles and things like that. So I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised and really enjoyed that aspect of the early part of your book.
Thanks so much. I think the beauty of it is a lot in the detail and in the flow of the story as it all there. You know, the PFRA did a great job of like writing a story on each year. And that's about, but otherwise you just get little bits and pieces and several books or articles, but to really understand the characters a little better and the decision making and the consequences of their various decisions that they had to make at different times. I mean, Blondie was such a trailblazer that, you know, he went all in and took full financial control and responsibility for that team in Canton in 1906 when the Canton Club lost money itself in 1905 and said they weren't going to support it anymore. He said, fine, I'll do it, you know, and no professional team had ever made money before. So it was a huge gamble and he had to make all the, you know, contractual decisions and salary decisions himself and, you know, whatever they made or lost, you know, it was on him. So he had a lot on it on his mind and his back. He didn't even play, you know, that season part because he had so much else to do. But you know, trying to build a team that would beat Maslin after losing to them in, you know, in 1905, when he had guaranteed victory, you know, that his reputation was on the line too, and he was trying to. It turns out, you know, build a business and become a resident of Canton afterward. That was his ultimate goal. And that would only happen, you know, success if he won. So he had a lot, you know, on the line and it's part of the drama of it all.
They're recruiting these players from all around the country. We know, you know, your great grandfather coming from Pittsburgh to play up in Maslin. You know, Canton was doing the same thing. A few of the other teams in the area were probably doing similar things. Now, what were like the housing arrangements for these players that would come in from out of state and out of town? Did they board them up somewhere? Or?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, growing up, I had always just kind of assumed or maybe heard. I can't be sure with it. Maybe my grandfather went back and forth on the train to the games on the weekend from Pittsburgh, where he worked for the Westinghouse Corporation or Westinghouse Airbrake. It still exists today, WABCO, amazingly. Mm-hmm. But no, it turns out he would go out there and all of them would for the season and they would get a break from work. You know, they'd get excused. And they lived in a hotel. Each team won, you know, Matt, I think in, not sure I'm going to get this right. One of them was the Cortland Hotel. And I can't recall for sure if that was Maslin or Canton. And there was another hotel in the other town. And in Maslin, there was an athletic club called the Maslin Athletic Club. And it still stands, the building is still there. And I visit it, you know, when I go there, it's an incredible facility. It had hardwood, you know, gym, basketball floor, an elevated running track, like the old days around, you know, above the floor, a big swimming pool in the basement. You know, there are still two stone tigers, you know, on the side of the front doors until recently. There's a lot of renovation going on there. But the building has survived and it's pretty special.
Yeah, no, I think you tell the story really well. You tell how Maslin got their moniker of the Tigers, and I'd like you to share it with us. And you also have some stories which are pretty plausible of how Canton became the Bulldogs. If you don't mind sharing those,
right? Stories. That was fun. Well, the first one was easy. I mean, that was pretty well known how EJ Stewart, when he was managing the team, I guess in 1903, their first big year, had to go and buy some uniforms. And there was a local sporting goods store apparently in Maslin, and all they had in any volume was Princeton Tigers jerseys, because they were, the best college team in the country pretty much every year, along with Yale. And, Harvard was never quite up to their level, and Penn kind of came along later, and the others were sort of afterthoughts. But he bought black jerseys with orange stripes on the sleeves, and they became the Maslin Tigers. And that was that. So I really enjoyed recently speaking at Maslin High School 2 days before the rivalry game with Canton a couple weeks ago, and sharing that story with them. And they love it. They don't even know these things. So Canton, on the other hand, I'd never heard, any related story. And I was, when I got to the point in the book to think about that and maybe write about it, I was excited. I was like, I'm going to go down that route and figure this one out now. And I mean, I had all the resources, all the Canton newspapers, and, going day by day, week by week, and to find, I thought it would be a revelation to find the first time that the Canton repository mentioned the Canton Bulldogs. And I'd had several cartoons and things, that came into my collection over time, but I never really organized them or gone sequentially. And darn it, when I finally did, it was kind of anticlimactic. It was just, there was no explanation. It was just one day toward the end of the 1906 season, right before the big match, first matchup with Maslin, when the Canton team was down at Penn State training, that they just start calling them the Bulldogs. I'm like, wait a minute, some story there? Was it Blondie's idea? Was it the newspaper? Who came up with this? There was nothing there. And so I just started sort of letting that sink in and marinate it. And finally it just dawned on me that, if Maslin took the Princeton Tigers, Canton probably, being the rival, took the Yale Bulldogs as the next best name, to have as big a brand as the Tigers did. And so that's my guess. And I put it in the book, and I clearly state it's my guess and opinion, but that's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I never had put that connection together, and I had wondered that myself. I knew the story of Maslin. I either learned it from you or from George Bozica or one of the historians down that way. And, nobody could ever explain where the Bulldogs came from. But just like you said, it just popped up in a newspaper one day, and that's what they were from there on. And but reading that in the book, it was really refreshing, and it sort of brings some closure to me. And I think that's a very plausible explanation of why, because, definitely college football back in that time was far bigger than professional football. And pro football could only aspire and hope to be, half of what college football was at the time. But those two powerhouses of Princeton and Yale, they were definitely the caveats of the gridiron for sure.
Definitely, and Blondie, tried to break that up a few years later. I mean, Yale and Princeton dominated through all the 1870s, 80s, 90s, but it wasn't probably until late 1890s and early 1900s that Penn got in the mix and maybe snuck in a couple championships.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, some other elements of the book, you have some great graphics in there of, newspaper clippings and souvenir programs from some of the games and photographs, and just some really a smorgasbord of delight for the football historian as you're reading these stories and these little sidebars that they take you on that really complement the book And, you know, it's very well done. And, you know, it was extremely entertaining and very, very colorful. And I also love the way how you took some of the pages, you know, especially maybe starting a chapter was a big story, and you enlarge the letters to put emphasis on it and some colorful background to it. And it leads into the story. It was just, I found it extremely pleasing to the eye and to the entertainment value and the learning process of, you know, what this book has to offer. So I thank you for that. It's really quite a pleasure. And I think the listeners that go and buy this book, I think you will find it extremely, you know, pleasing as well.
Well, thanks so much. You know, what I didn't expect in the design of the book, what was, I thought my job would be done just writing it. And I had been working with a company that was helping with edit, layout and design and everything. And at some point I said, okay, we paused after the first half of the book. And I said, I want to take a break from all this and work on the design layout of that. Let's do that for a while. And so we got into that, and I thought they were going to do that. And they said they would do that. And they just said, well, put, you know, your favorite pictures in the folders and we'll work on it. And magically I thought it would be done. And of course, nothing's that simple. And I was totally not satisfied with their first effort at placing pictures. And, you know, they weren't even on the pages where they were, you know, referenced in the text. I said, oh my gosh. So I ended up, long story short, having to do it myself. And it turned out to be incredibly fun. I didn't look at it as a burden at all. I loved looking at my text and saying, okay, what picture should be there? And if I didn't have one, I went and found it somewhere online or through a dealer or a book or the Hall of Fame. And I just had a vision for, you know, the right pictures being in the right places and balancing the color with all the old black and white ones. You had to have enough color in there. But I did have help from a great layout guy who I just basically put up my vision on PowerPoint pages, and which was totally revolutionary to him. He said, nobody ever thought this. I said, I want to do this myself. He said, you can't do the software. I said, well, fine, I'll just put it on a PowerPoint and then you put it in the software. So he did. And that's, he said, you know, I said, I don't know how else you would do it. For how have you done every other book in your career? He said, I don't know, but we have, but this makes sense and let's keep going. And so we, of course, he had ideas and input and refined pictures and we came up with sort of a flow where the beginning of each chapter had a main picture, sort of like you said, to introduce one of the most powerful pictures, you know, to enter that chapter and emphasize, sort of give a hint of what was to come. So from there, it was just a patchwork, trying to make things, you know, different and have some variety and people and 3D objects, programs, tickets, pennants, you know, whatever I collected over time. Some of them I just took pictures myself and cropped them and let him, you know, format them for the chapter. So it was just a big art project that was kind of unexpected but I think, you know, maybe the most rewarding part of the whole thing.
Well, the magic that you and your team did, it definitely is effective. You know, tells an effective story. And, you know, talking about, you know, you have that, the general story, like we talked about, but you have some of these, what I'm calling sort of sidebar stories. And I think maybe at least one of them came about, maybe your research, it took you down a road to maybe changing history. There's one aspect of it. And I know you wrote a PFRA piece in the Coffin Corner a few years back on the first professional pass and some information that you garnered that changes what was believed for, you know, decades as being the first professional pass. So maybe if you don't mind talking about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, people listening to this podcast most likely know the name Peggy Parrott, George Peggy Parrott. He was just up for on the ballot from the PFRA this past month for the Hall of Very Good, among a long list of others. And so he's a about as big a name as it gets from that, that pre-NFL period. He was known for the funny story of being outed at, when he played in college at Case University for wearing the disguise on his face and playing under the name Jimmy Murphy. And but when the reporters, he took off on this long touchdown run and people sort of figured out who he was, and he got called into the president's office and, you know, said, "I understand you're playing professionally, you know, somewhere. Is that true?" And he just said, "Absolutely." And he, and I'd do it again. And he was kicked out. So he went on to play for Massillon the next year. And 1906, which was the big year of the rule changes and the first forward pass, and forever he's been, you know, just accepted as the quarterback who, you know, who threw the first forward pass against Moundsville Benwood from West Virginia, and, you know, Dan, you know, Bullet Riley, whose real name was Polakowski, you know, because he was from Canton and didn't want to be known that he was playing for Massillon, caught the pass. And but it never kind of, you know, as I'm writing it, it didn't add up that was kind of about the fourth or fifth game of the season. I'm like, is it possible that, you know, the pass happened before that? And in my research, I developed a friendly relationship with Tim Heslop, who's a volunteer at the Hall of Fame, and he would bounce ideas and fact check with me for various articles and projects he worked on over time. And he always joked with me. He said, "I don't know about your great grandfather snapping the ball for the first forward pass. You know, one of these days we're going to prove that it was somebody else, you know." And I said, "Okay, you just," you know, he said, "I'm working on this project now." I said, "Well, let me know how that works out." And so just about that time, actually a couple of years before that, I'd been to Massillon and had a real treat, by being taken into the archives of the Massillon Booster Club by some real old timers, you know, and guys named like Gene Berner, I think, was the head of the club at that time, who's passed away since. And Ron Prunty, who's still with us, incredible Jack LaLanne, that very fit guy who still does the video for the Massillon High School games. And he carries a camera, a video around with him almost everywhere he goes. He's like doing candid camera. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago and he came into the Massillon Museum with his video camera. And the day I was in this old archive, this old middle school where they kept like Paul Brown's hat and, you know, just amazing things, he got out some original 1906 newspapers that he thought I'd be interested in. And right. And he actually went, like, had them laminated, like the vision to, that they were important, but well before that, because he knew enough about football and that, you know, these games that this, they should be protected. And right away, I noticed that these were daily papers from the 1906 season. And that the only thing ever on microfilm in the libraries in Massillon or even in Columbus, like the state libraries, were the weekend papers of the Massillon Gleaner. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is nobody ever, I mean, seen these. And so he was nice enough to make copies of them, and, you know, at Kinko's, and send me a big tube of these papers that sat in my office for a couple of years until I got to the part of the book I was ready to write about that season after writing about the Pittsburgh era. And I'm going through these papers sequentially and you know, there it is, you know, one day in like the second game of the season, it says clear as a bell, you know, Tigers throw forward pass for the first time. Moran, you know, worked the pass beautifully to Parrott for, you know, at two touchdowns or something. What, who, Moran? I mean, who? How did that happen? How was he the quarterback? And what turned out was Blondie Wallace had stolen the tight end, or they call it end at that time, a guy named Clark Schrantz from Massillon, paid him more money to go to the Bulldogs. So they were short an end, and they took Parrott because he was a basketball player and had good hands, and they moved him up to end. And Charlie Moran had played a lot of quarterback at Tennessee or Vanderbilt. He played at some different Southern schools. And they plugged him in there, and that was their plan, you know, to go through the season. And the first week there was no forward passing. It was a lot of mud, and, you know, there was no evidence of a pass for them or the Canton team. It just couldn't have been more clear. It was black and white. So I called Tim up and I said, "Hey, Tim, how's that project going?" He's like, "Oh, Greg, you know, we got some bad news for you. You know, we got on whatever date, October 15th or something, some other Shelby threw a forward pass on this Sunday, you know, and so on. We don't know who the quarterback was, but, you know, it says there was a pass." And I said, "What day was that?" And he says, "October, I think it was the 15th. And I said, "Tim, I think I got you by a day." And he says, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, I got the gleaner." He said, "How did you get that gleaner?" I said, where did you get that? You know, did you get it from the Massillon Museum?" I said, "No." I said, "I can't tell you. I'd have to kill you until the book's done." But he said, "Son of a gun, I just wrote the article for the PFRA and submitted it. It's gone to print. After all these years, I thought we had a scoop." And I said, "Well, it looks like I'm going to have to write the next one." So he said, "Darn it, go for it." But he was glad I did. You know, we're sort of partners in research, but we were glad to be able to put a name with it and have something so definitive. But in the end, I was even personally glad that, yes, my great grandfather still did snap the ball for the first forward pass, even though it was to a different quarterback.
Yeah, he couldn't disprove that part of his gold, could he? So,
right. But no, sadly, Moran got hurt in that game, and Parrott ended up coming back in as quarterback for the rest of the season, and that's how he was, you know, threw a pass a couple of weeks later. So,
wow, that's incredible. That's a great story, and glad you could preserve that football history and make it clear and bring the recognition that Moran and the others deserve to get for throwing that first forward pass. So
he's a pretty prominent guy later in life as a baseball umpire too. They called him Uncle Charlie. He was a major league umpire until the 30s. And so he's pretty, he also coached at, I think it's called Center College in Kentucky when they beat, I think it was Harvard, they called it the biggest upset of the first half of the century or something like that.
He was the coach of Center. Okay.
He was.
Oh, yeah. Very interesting. Very nice. Now, I guess, the main part of your story is, learning about your great grandfather. And he is, like we said, a very central figure. And really, you bring it into a nice story out of, probably one of the darkest times of professional football ever. And, I don't know how much you want to get into that or not, but I would love to hear some of the basics, at least to whet our appetite of what's in the book.
Yeah. I think there's a lot deeper themes in human themes to the story than just a football history that really resonate with people. As I go out and I'm doing speaking events now and opportunities like this, some of these events are with business people and they want me to have business themes. And the one I'll be doing next week in Atlanta focuses on integrity and leadership and the character of, my great grandfather that I always heard about. And then I, was able to document in so many ways in publications was so clear that even as only an eighth grade graduate, that there was something about him that was in his character that led his fellow players who were all Americans in the Ivy League and Notre Dame and other schools that he would be their captain. I mean, that's pretty amazing, really, when you think about it, special. Yeah. So it was no surprise then when a gambler I don't want to get too much into the story, but somebody approached him with a bribe that he refused it. And this is like what my grandmother was always proud of, that he had the strength of character to say no and to report it. And even though he reported it to his coach, and which got reported to EJ Stewart, the manager, and they kind of made a big mess of the whole thing, which is really interesting, all the twists and turns of the drama from there. And it led to this cold case that's existed ever since, until now, when you look at the decisions that the different people made, you know, through this crisis, basically, and whether it was Blondie Wallace and how he sort of goes down in history as being a bad guy, but why, you know, was it true? Was it not? And that's really the essence of the mystery that I've been able to uncover by discovering a court file in Ohio. Blondie had sued the Massillon newspaper and team for libel because his reputation was being trashed, and he recognized he wouldn't have his future in Canton if he couldn't clear his name. And so he was never really able to do so. And finding this case finally that never got to court because officially he ran out of money. But everybody still is kind of assumed, especially since he became kind of a career criminal later. It was known that he was the king of the bootleggers and back in New Jersey, where he grew up in Atlantic City during Prohibition. He must have been a bad guy. He must have been guilty, you know, but there was never any evidence. But people said, well, they might have paid him off to go away, or he knew he was guilty and he let it drop. And, you know, finding the depositions from the people that were involved, it really clarifies exactly what happened. And again, I don't want to spoil the outcome, but it's not what they said in the newspapers. You know, there were lots of lies, and no surprise, you know, being in mistruths, being, you know, bantied about in the papers. So it's a revelation I meticulously picked the best excerpts from the case and put them word for word in the book. So I figured I couldn't do a better job, you know, of articulating what they said themselves. So I just list some really the juiciest parts of the case for people to read for themselves exactly what happened. So, but you know, whether it was Blondie's sort of flirtation, you know, with some of the people involved, and you know how he handled it and chose to handle it versus how, sorry, really affected the direction of their lives afterward. And I think that's one of the big lessons in the story, whether it's in business or sports or, you know, whatever aspect of life how your reputation and decisions you make have consequences.
So. Yeah, you did it so beautifully, the way that you crescendoed the story and brought it to its peak, you know, near the end. And without spoiling it, I can tell you as a reader, there's a sense of nostalgic euphoria and just a great feeling. I guess I can't really explain the feeling of reading it, and it's a great story, and I'm glad that you were able to record it in print and for all ages to enjoy going forward. You cleared up some great mysteries of football, and figured out some things that rewrote history, such as the first forward pass in professional football. So I don't want to leave the listeners any longer. Why don't you go ahead and tell us the title of the book again and where folks can get a copy? Mm-hmm.
So it's called Gridiron Legacy: Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. It's available at the book's website, gridironlegacy.com. And for now, that's the only place that it's available online. I spent actually a good bit of today trying to work with Amazon to figure out a way to get them to print and distribute it, but they aren't. They're just launching a beta, actually, to be able to print oversized hardback, color books. But there's very limited options in terms of, the specs and things. And it didn't work out technically or financially. So we're going to keep trying to find some other distribution sources. But for now, that's the only place it's available.
Folks, we will have links to it in the show notes of this podcast. We'll also have it on the corresponding article on Pigskin Dispatch in case you're in the car, don't have a pencil to write it down. But don't worry, we'll get you the links to get you to Greg and his fantastic book, which is needs to be in your collection of football history books, and definitely tells a great story, a great era, and the start of professional football. So Greg Fusari, thank you very much for joining us here and telling us your story of your family and of pro football, and for doing this great work of art. You know, it really is a work of art that you've done in or in distribution of.
Thanks, Darren. I appreciate that so much. It's always good to be with you.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.